Mr. Bear's Reel 5.
Carry on.
Please.
And these impossible places meant that you came up. It must have been horrifying to the German outpost, because they would be quite happily thinking that their front line was firmly ensconced, blocking this road and that track and what have you. And then we would suddenly turn up 4 or 5 miles behind where they thought they were. There were any English, the nasty English would turn up and start blasting them. Whether you hit them or not, it didn't matter. They would clear off. They always did clear off. Sometimes they fired back, sometimes they didn't, but they always cleared off. Now, straight away, that meant that the people who were further forward then got themselves in a state, because the people that were behind them had been attacked by... Well, they didn't know who. People with heavy machine guns and clad in odds and sods of uniform. They didn't really. They must have known we were regular forces because we had the jeeps, but they didn't know what regular forces, because we never had a prisoner taken except on one occasion, and that was towards the end of the war. We never had a prisoner taken at all. And when we did have that prisoner taken, we did get him back. But I'll come to that in a moment. So they never knew. So people who are further forward, and their commanders, who say, well, we better pull them back a bit. That lot have got round behind us. So all the time there was this whittling of their line in inaccessible places. And I was always surprised why they did not try and do something about it. We did, in fact, have some trouble with a couple of armoured cars. German armoured cars used to drive along a road, and we decided we were going to mine them, let them go past us one night. And it's marvellous in the mountains at night time, in wartime at least, they're quiet. You could hear a dog bark perhaps a mile away across the mountain. You thought, well, I wonder who's there. And you might see a flicker of somebody lighting a cigarette, and you'll think, I wonder if it's an Italian contadini, or is it a German soldier having a little smoke. So when these armoured cars used to go along this road, to get at them, we had to cross, once again, I call it a mountain stream, but it was a bit wider than a mountain stream. In so much to my memory, it was about 15 yards wide, but it was fordable. And the plan was that we were going to let these armoured cars drive past. And then when they came back again, we'd have it all mined, so that when they came back in the morning, they'd go over these mines. Whether they ever did, they didn't, in my sight, go over the mines on the way back. Whether they just missed them or not. I know that we did have a casualty that night, because I was covering their withdrawal across this stream, and it was everybody was trying to find their way. It was unfamiliar country to us, the other side of this mountain stream. And then I heard a dulcet Scots voice saying, "Lofty, Lofty," which was my nickname. And I said, "Here's Skipper," and he started across the stream, and he fell over. And if you've ever heard of a Scotsman mad with rage, he bashed his chin on a hidden rock. We had to go to the casualty clearing station where he get back to be stitched up. He had a terrific gash, but if you've ever heard a mad Scotsman swearing in a mixture of Scots and Italian, at the top of his voice in the middle of no man's land, this was Bob Uni. However, there we are. He was a great chap, but absolutely fearless. I often would have liked to have seen him again after the war, but I think he was killed as a mercenary. I met him once, but then he disappeared from our ken. So we concluded our stay in the mountains. Then Potsy had one of his good ideas. So he could not understand why we couldn't load a jeep into a dock. That was an amphibious, another way to describe it, was an amphibious lorry with a boat body out at sea, and have another dock with a crane to lift the jeeps out when they got onto dry land, and then the docks to return to the tank landing craft. And we did in fact try it, and it did work, and that opened a new era for us, because from that stage we decided, or the powers that be decided, we could land anywhere and do anything and still have the facility to get back with our jeeps if we wanted to, but only using docks and leaving the landing craft further out to sea. So having decided this, then one of the major attacks started to break through the line by Rimini. Now, there are all things said about the battle for San Marino. In some of the books, they say we went in, there were patrols in it. There were two. I know who went into San Marino. I went into San Marino with one other jeep. And we were driven out of San Marino by one extraordinary feat of arms. We were driven out of San Marino. I drove with this other jeep right into the middle of San Marino. And then all hell's delight descended on us. From the great rock that overshadows San Marino, there were grenades, mortar bombs, machine gun fire, you name it, that decided it was a very unhealthy place. There was nobody else in there. They had signs as you went into San Marino, this is a neutral state, please be careful, or words to that effect. They were riddled with shellfire and bullet holes, but there was no other patrol in there when I went in. There was nobody in there except I and one other jeep. I think JC was driving my jeep. But we were driven out by this tremendous feat of arms by somebody who got to the top of the cliff and was throwing everything down on top of us from the cliff, and we were glad to get off it with our lives. An amusing aside here, I must diverge a little bit, because after the war I was sitting in the foyer of a restaurant in Suffolk, and my old school friend, he played inside three-quarter for me when I was the wing three-quarter for the school team, came up and says, "Hello, how'd you get on?" And this was immediately after the war. I think we were both still on sort of demobilisation leave. And so I said, "I didn't have a bad time. How did you get on?" He said, "I didn't either." He said, "I was out in the Central Mediterranean." I said, "Oh, yes, which regiment?" He said, "I was a subaltern with the Gurkhas." And so I said, "Oh." I said, "I think they're the finest of the troops of either side." And so he was pleased about this. He said, "Great chaps." And I said, "Yes, they are great chaps. I remember a Gurkha who had been badly wounded, and he insisted on getting off his stretcher in the casualty clearing station so I could have it, and I wasn't really much matter with me. And we had quite a little friendly discussion, but the casualty clearing station people said, 'For Pete's sake, get off. As far as he's concerned, he's a Gurkha and you're an Englishman, and you rate high with him, so he's got to get up, get off the stretcher, and you've got to have it,' which I did. Anyway, I was talking to Peter, and I said, 'Oh, where did you go?' And so he said, we fought in the around Rimini. I said, 'Oh, yes.' I said, 'Wasn't that a marvellous effort?' I said, 'Who was it? Do you know ever find out who got up that cliff that overlooks the centre of San Marino?' And he said, 'Yes.' He said, I took a company of the Gurkhas up there with mortars and what have you. And I said, 'Well, do you realise you've nearly knocked me off?' And then we had a quiet drink. We were happy as sandboys, laughing about how he tried to knock me off all those years later. So from who took Rimini, San Marino? Well, the two jeeps of PPA were the first ones in there. No question of any other patrols when I went right in the thing. And who shot me out? My old friend from schoolboy days had thrown me out of it. The attack there then faltered and phased out. Rimini fell, and they pushed off up towards Ravenna, and the winter came, and everything was greatly bogging down in the typically Italian winter. Now, at this stage, there was a great shortage of all forms of infantry on the ground. And this was helped a little bit by the mountains, where the number of people that were involved were fewer per square mile, and on the coast, where the Germans had flooded the whole of the low-lying marshland from the sea to Ravenna. So all you had little hummocks of land, like the woods south of Ravenna, which were just a little bit proud of the level. You had a railway line running through it, which stood up so it was about 3 feet above the water level. But everything was a sea of water and marshland. Some of the patrols, I think, and I'm only just quoting this because I didn't go on any of them, started using the ducks. I think P Patrol uses the ducks to land on, make several landings there behind this waterlogged thing. But B Patrol, we were stuck in the woods there with a partisan group under Bula, and we lived in these woods. And we were then told to keep the Germans occupied. Well, Don Galloway and Spiv Rogers and I, we were given a house on this railway line. I presume it was a signalman's house. And it looked about 600 yards down to where the bridge was blown. And the Germans were in the village the other side of the bridge. Now, when we were there, Bob Uni, the skipper, said, look, you three, you're holding a company front. If you don't go out there and do a patrol every night, if they send a patrol out, you've had it. We can't do anything about it. So we dismounted one of the 30 Brownings. When I say 30, I mean a 30mm Brownings, and mounted it up in the front room of this signalman's cottage. And we kept the door shut. We thought the Germans won't come at daytime. If they come looking for us, they'll come at night. So we kept the door and everything shut during the day. And at night time, we opened the door and the machine gun was peering down this railway track. They couldn't come at us in numbers unless they used the railway track, because each side of the railway line was about 3 foot deep in water. So every night, one of us, sometimes two of us, would go out and go up to where this bridge was blown over a canal. I presume it's a canal. It might have been a river, but I always took it as being a canal. And fire a few very lights and throw a few grenades over to make sure they didn't send any patrols looking for us. We were all getting very tired, because it meant that whoever was on duty, there were two of us always kept awake at night. So you roughly had a sort of a couple of hours sleep, and that was your lot for the night. You got very sleepy. Bob Uni, the skipper, he was the maddest soldier that I ever saw. He was afraid of nothing. He said one night, he said, come on, he came up, and he used to push a wheelbarrow up this embankment, up this track, this wheelbarrow track, with some food and anything else he thought we might need at night time. And he said, well, to us, he said, well, where do you think the German machine guns are? And I said, I don't know where they are. And Don Galloway said, no, neither do we. We don't know where the machine guns are. We hear them firing at night, but we can't see any sign of them. And so he said, Oh, he said, I'll find out where they were. And he said, one of you, and he said, come on with me. So I thought, well, I had a hadn't been on the guard duty at the drawing room, right-o, skipper. And he said, come on with me. And he always would have a short white duffel coat. I don't know where he scrounged it from. He had a short white duffel coat on. I said, I don't think you'll need that on, skipper. Oh, he said, yes, I shall. And so off we go. And we start floundering around in where we can find a little bit of dry to stand on. And then he said, now Lofty, he said, I'm going to stand up. You lie down there. Then I'm going to fire a very light in the sky. And they'll see me. And then you can plot their machine gun positions. But don't you move your head, because they've fired everything. They can't fail to see me. Now I thought... He's trying to commit suicide, but he didn't get shot. He stood there, and there was all kinds of machine guns opened up. But he just stood there and said, is that one over there, or that one over there? And I said, yes, yes, yes. And then the very light went off. He said, well, now we know. He said, we'll go back. So we went back. Well, he's not content with this. He said, we don't really know whether there are Germans in that village over the bridge or not. Well, it was an iron bridge, a typical railway bridge. And he said, by which time J.C. had joined us, and he said, Gail, he said, J.C. can stay here, and Gail, that was Galloway's nickname, of course, Galloway and Lofty, come on, we'll go and have a look at this village. We've gone over to this village, and he said, Lofty, you stay this side and cover us, and we'll swing across on these girders and see whether there are any Germans in this village. So over they swung over, and I could hear what I thought were army ammunition boots of some kind walking about there. The Germans were very silly about this kind of thing. And they got penetrated right, and Don Galloway and the skipper penetrated right into the middle of this village and could be listening to what they're to them talking. And they came swinging back, and Bob Uni said, oh, I must tell Popsky this, they are in that village. I reckon there's more than a dozen. And so off he went, toddling away, still pushing his wheelbarrow down the railway track. And we were left for another while. It was cold. It was so cold. The wind then, it was wind when it was coming over these marshes from the sea. We were always frozen. My biggest danger there, I think, was some way behind us and on our left flank, I think it was the Cheshires with heavy Vickers machine guns with Mark 8 barrels, which you laid down Harrison fire. And our only water we could get was from a pump in the back of the back of the farmhouse. And we couldn't be seen from the Germans, so I thought, well, I'll go out there one day and we'll get a bit of water, and when they can't see any fire smoke or what have you, we'll have a cup of tea. And so I walked out of the back carrying this bucket, and the Cheshires, who were everywhere with this heavy machine gun battery, there's some 2,000 or 3,000 yards behind, they really could shoot, because they started tat, 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 the typical Vickers steady old tat, tat, tat noise, and they put holes in my water bucket. And that was the last time we tried to go out there at daytime. We told them the next time we saw Bob Uni, tell the Cheshires to we're here. They might think they're in the front line, but we're here. And that was it. So some days later, Popsky was allocated as we did all the raiding and patrolling for a force that was made up of all kinds of odds and sods. Don't forget, the three of us had been holding a company front, But they thought the powers that be thought this was a bit thin on the ground, even for them. So they made up a force called Porter Force, commanded by Colonel Horsburgh Porter. Subsequently became the hunting correspondent of the field after the war was over, but that's by the way. A very tall chap, commanding off to the 27th Lancers. And so we had the 27th Lancers. A battery or two of priests, that's one of 5mm self-propelled guns. They were mounted on a Sherman chassis. A couple of squadrons of, or perhaps even, I don't know how they work it out in the RAF regiment, anywhere about 100 or 200 RAF regiment to be used as infantry, and a few tanks. The Canadians offered Potsky, according to the war diary, they offered him 5 tanks because they thought we would need tanks to contain this lot. 4 of them with 75mm and 2 of them with a gun which was only used to, of course, which was the 17-pounder. We call them fireflies, but Potsky turned these down on the grounds quite rightly, that we could do far better rather than on our own feet and with our own jeeps, and we could do floundering around with tanks bringing down a lot of fire and a lot of opposition when we could cope with it quite happily on our feet with surprise. Anyway, we were attached to Porter Force, and having found a ford further up, we forded some jeeps over, and that particular day Potsky came with us, and B Patrol went with him. I think 4 jeeps and Potsky jeep, and I travelled with Potsky as his bodyguard. I've never seen Potsky more pleased, because the 4 jeeps went ambling down this road along the bank, as if they were going for a flank attack, along the bank to this village, and there wasn't a sound. And we had a staff officer there who turned round to Potsky and said, for one sure chap's made a mistake, Potsky. And that was the actual words he used. And Potsky turned to me and he said, Lofty, were there any Germans in that village? I said, well, there were 2 nights ago. And so the staff officer said, well, there aren't any there now. And the next minute, there were grenades and Tommy guns and submachine guns and machine guns going off in this village. And Potsky said, off you go, Lofty, you better go off and give them a hand. So I'd amble down into this village and doing a general hand. There were, I think, 9 of us in the village then. Immediately on my left hand was Steve Walbridge, who was a subaltern in PPA, a West Indian chap, a great swimmer. And so he was on my left hand side. I can't remember who was on my right hand side. We're indulging in some quite close quarter, house to house fighting. The Germans were not really, I thought, very determined about it. I went round the corner of a house in the garden shed there was a German machine gun. There were 2 of them in it, and they surrendered to me. Steve Walbridge, I couldn't get through to them because they were in the next little garden. They all had barbed wire fences for some unknown reason, and I called out to Steve, they're yours, Steve. So Steve Walbridge had those, and he had their loot. And we carried on. We used to pop. We really did enjoy it. We were professionals then. We really were professional soldiers. We were not not regular army, or should I say, official army troops that didn't know where they were doing or what they were supposed to do, who had to be led by somebody else. We were professionals. We could have taken on any troops, I think, in the world. We used to have great fun. I never threw a grenade in my life. I used to walk up as I did in this village, and the Germans were great for their defensive works were always good. They often used to make them in haystacks and straw stacks, digging underneath. And our great fun was to pop a grenade, just drop a grenade in one end and then run around the other end to shoot them as they ran out. There was always some competition amongst us whether we were going to get them before they got out, or try and shoot them so they fell back inside. We really were professionals, and we enjoyed our work. And after we cleared this village, the nine of us, I think we took 12 prisoners, 3 machine guns, one rocket launcher,
Panzerfaust,
and 2 or 3machine pistols. So we didn't think the nine of us had done badly.
What was the name of the village?
I can't remember the name of the village. I was trying to see it. I was trying to find that railway line on that map, because that passed through it, and I couldn't find the railway line. And it doesn't show. I'll have a look in Popsy's book.
Don't worry about it.
And it might give you the name of the village. Well, there we are. We're now across this canal, and round towards the coast was a massive tower. Now, people had tried to shell it. This wall's actually turned out to be 9 feet thick, and it completely overlooked everything that we wanted to do or anybody else wanted to do. It had a guard in a straw stack. They slept in this straw stack, and they did their observation. They were extraordinary. They should have been court-martialed for absolute dereliction of duty. I said we were professionals. We were more professionals than they were, because they didn't seem to be pushing out any kind of information. S-Patrol were busy taking prisoners and raiding these, infiltrating at night and raiding these strong points and taking them. And this tower and these things, well, we picked up with a chap named Alberto. Now, Alberto, ignore all the kind of books you read. Alberto farmed there. No matter what he said, he became a great friend of mine. I still have his civilian identity card, for which he gave me as a memento. And Alberto told us that the German garrison there always used to deliver milk to them at 6 o'clock in the morning, or thereabouts, and used to take a can of milk up. And he offered to guide us through